Right, thank you everybody. I'll now introduce our main speaker for this evening. It's Clancy I, whose home group is the Pacific Group in Los Angeles. Thank you, Clancy.
My name is Clancy Imesland, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very glad to be here, glad to be back here as part of this reunion, get-together, convention, whatever it might be. I was sitting there thinking of the first time I came here. Travers, somehow, he and I got acquainted, and he invited me to come to Europe to spend a few days to talk. So I said, okay, I'd never been around any AA in this area, in Europe. And I came to, he met me in London, we went up to Glasgow, of all places, and he got in a car and we drove to Dumfries for the Blue Bonnet Convention. At that time, I remember I was kind of shocked. I had not been anywhere like this. And everyone smoked in those days. Just everyone smoked. And you talk to this big room full of Scots people, all you see is a sea of smoke. There's nobody out there at all. And I hope they're staying for the meeting, you know. And every once in a while, a whiff of wind would blow by, and you'd see the clouds would part. Hundreds of little guys, each with a cigarette, it's great, it's great. And we safely got out of there, and the next night we went to Dublin, which I had never been to. I was thrilled to go to Dublin, and I gave a talk there, and then spent a couple hours just studying the post office with all the bullet holes, and sorry I missed all the fun. And then we went to Bristol, where I was last night, and Bristol was really an experience in 1989, I guess it was, 88, 89. While we were sitting in the meeting, while I was talking, you could hear explosions around of the troubles going on. And the leader made an interesting statement. He said, this room is the only room in North Ireland where Catholics and Protestants are sitting down in peace tonight. It just sends a shiver down your spine to think about that. Then we came over to Bristol and had a good time here. And he drove me around and showed me Bath. And had this meeting, and I thought that'd be the end of it. But then he invited me back another time, and I've come back several times since then. Now I seem to go through Bristol. I was there last night. And before that, I was in Dublin for a change. A lot of the Dublin guys are here tonight. They couldn't quite gather all the truth that I put out to them in one sitting. They're back with their tape recorders tonight. Bad cess to you. But I am glad to be here, and I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober and enjoy the 10-minute speakers. Every speaker likes to know that the 10-minute speaker is only going to take 4 minutes. That gives me six more minutes. The second one went a little long. He went nine. But I pity your sponsor. He must be a saint. But you know, tomorrow I said to Sally, what's the schedule for the weekend? She says, well, Saturday night at the what's it called?
Council House.
I'd have thought of that in a minute. This is not a choral group now. I'll do all the speaking here until I need you again. She said, well, we'd like to have you give your, you know, tell your story. And I said, well, what do I talk about Friday night? She said, well, whatever you think is important about AA, something important to AA. And so I'm going to talk a few minutes about something that I think is important to AA. Because we're in kind of for some time now, we've been a little bit at a crossroads, people feel. You know, this is kind of an interesting time of year. End of October, Bill Wilson was getting sober and was going to really make it this time. And he had great hopes, and he lasted till November 11th when he got drunk again and went on his final drunk in 1934. But AAA's been around since 1935, of course, it's June. And ever since the 50th anniversary, sometimes the 50th, it was mentioned a little bit at the 50th anniversary, not too much, a little bit at the 55th, it's come up in the last couple of years. A number of people have come to the conclusion that it's time, really, that we ought to change some of our procedures because we should more keep up with modern times and modern things. That the things age nice, but it's a little dated, a little out of date. And they have about four categories, I think, that that people seem to feel strongly about. One is that maybe the book is a little bit out of date. Maybe we should change some of the terminology in the book. In fact, it came up last year at the World Service Conference, and it was voted down. But it was went out to all the groups, do you think we should change the book? And there are little isolated pockets of people who have different feelings about it. For example, there's a group of feminists who take exception to the fact that throughout the book God is called him, and it should be God, to change the step to say God as we understand God, and rather, because it isn't a matter, God is not necessarily a masculine figure. And then there's some discussion at length about, aren't we just a little too stringent these days about our membership requirements? We want people to be alcoholics, and in this world today, there's a lot of people who have all the problems we have who are not really alcoholics, but they're on drugs and other things. And isn't it just a little bit iconoclastic to make them be say that you have to be an alcoholic to be a full-fledged member? A third source of discussion around the world is, isn't the Lord's Prayer just a little too religious? I mean, it's a religious prayer. It isn't a good prayer like the Serenity Prayer. Some countries refuse to say the Lord's Prayer. Some groups in Minneapolis, Minnesota, in the middle of Wisconsin, in the middle of America, a couple years ago, there was a master movement because they said this Christian prayer was offending Jewish members, and they started to stop saying it. And then, of course, the final place that there's still discussion is, aren't we getting just a little too strict about this? Are we becoming doctors in telling people they can't take antidepressants and medications for their emotions? And aren't we taking on a little more than we can chew? And isn't that just a little bit too much? And so I want to tonight just take up these four items and look at them and see what we think about it, and give you my opinion. I travel around a lot. I've been active for a lot of years. And so I've had a chance in the last few years to talk in exotic places like Cape Town and Berlin and Sydney and Christchurch and all the states of the United States and all of Canada and Oslo and Stockholm, a lot of places. And I've heard a lot of people talk, and because I'm interested in AA, and it's been a long time since I've been sober. Next week will be 46 years with my sobriety date. And I have an interest in AA, and I hope an open mind so I can listen to the arguments, at least make up my mind for me. I don't make up my mind for AA, obviously, because AA is larger than me or my opinion by multitudinous quantities. But you take that first one, should the book be changed? And there have been some fairly good arguments propounded that maybe they're writing the terminology, that it's a little out of date, it's a little passe, that modern readers don't find it very interesting. And that's always been kind of interesting to me, and I felt that way the first time I read the book in 1949. You know, I thought it was out of date then, as far as I was concerned. And so I understand the feeling. But you know, the book is an interesting thing. It has been described by many people as a miracle. And if you're like me, you're a little cynical about miracles. You know, miracles, you hear old fools get up in AA and say things like, I had a miracle this morning. I got up very early and I saw the sunrise. And I knew I'd been given another day. And it was a miracle. Oh, Jesus. Why don't you get up early tomorrow and have another one, you goof? Miracles are supposed to be things that are unexplainable, inexplicable, to correctly say the word. Miracles are supposed to be things that cannot be described. And I think one of the reasons that they ascribe that to this book was written by a man 3 years sober. If you're new tonight, you may think, well, 3 years sober. God, you should know enough to write a book by then. But when you get to be 3 years sober, you'll discover you don't know enough to write a book. By the time you're 5 years sober, you just try to be nice to people 3 years sober. Keep coming back, Jimmy. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober to get your coffee. Is that two sugars and one cream or two cream? Never mind, I'll do it. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. Nothing against them, it's just it's a good... This guy, 3 years sober, sat down, surrounded by failure. We forget that, you know. We keep thinking of all those early AAs were just dedicated, wonderful people, takes over. Very few of them did. Very few of them did. In the back of the first edition of the book, the first printing, where he put in those 12 stories of the people he thought might have the best stories, most of those people died drunk. Most of those people in the second printing died drunk. Failure was a big thing, and they were not like the Christians in the catacombs because alcoholism, they didn't understand alcoholism. Even the good guys, a lot of them got drunk, because at that time they didn't realize you have to keep doing it even after you're feeling better. It wasn't that they were malicious or bad, but surrounded mainly by failure, for the worst of motives, he wrote this damn book to make some money so they could build some hospitals. That's the purpose of writing the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And no background in psychology, no background in abnormal psychology or medicine or anything else. Just watching the few people staying sober around him and applying them to his own mind, he sat down and wrote this damn book. What's so miraculous about that? Well, the miracle is that goofy book has changed more alcoholic lives in the last 57 years, 56 years, than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. That is a miracle. And there's people who want to change the book, and they completely forget the fact the book is not designed to be a potboiler. It is designed to work on human emotions. And we say, well, it's kind of out of date. I'm going to tell you something. Human emotions are never out of date. They're exactly the same as they've always been. When I get very, very upset, I get upset in exactly the same way the Pharaoh of Egypt got upset. Except I don't have any Jewish children to kill. Well, I'm looking, though. But emotions are emotions, and they always have been. Human emotions have never changed. You can read back 5,000 years about human emotions and identify with them. The actions, the scientific aspects of it all different. But this book is designed to quell emotional excess in people who have found a chemical escape from reality. And what will they change? I don't know what they'll change, but I, for one, will not... I would want to see it work for a long time before I accepted it. Because this works. And I think that argument, changing the book, which incidentally came from newer people, we don't have to be concerned what newer people think because they don't know very much yet. Not to be cruel, they know a great deal about some things, but not about this book. This book is really a jewel. You know, it's a funny thing. Every August, I read at a book study. You read a chapter a week, and then they break into groups and discuss it. And I've been doing that for 30 years. And I've read that book through a number of times. And to this day, when I read it, I'm always amazed at how well it's put together. When you read it aloud, you have to read every word, and it makes sense. when you're reading it to yourself, you skim, you just jump pages and jump sentences, and I know that. But when you read it aloud, it really is remarkable. It's a remarkable book. That book is a miracle. And I hope that in my day, in your day, it will always stay that way. One of the great problems, of course, today is this idea of, aren't we getting a bit too selfish, demanding that people be alcoholics? After all, isn't it all one big disease? Alcoholism, drug addiction, gambling, overeating. Do you know where that phrase came from? It's all one big disease. It came from a treatment center that only had one bus. Go on to the meeting, just tell them whatever they want to hear. Why should we be so concerned about being an alcoholic? And to think about that, you have to stop and think about a little bit of the history of where it came from, this concept that our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholics who still suffer, not people who still suffer, but alcoholics who still suffer. Why would that be? As most of you remember and know, of course, that in 1939, AA was stumbling forward. They issued this book. It didn't do much sales. They didn't have enough money to buy a hospital. Couldn't even buy a bus ticket to the hospital. And in 1941, they had a little article in Liberty magazine that made it sound like a religious organization, did no good. And then at the end of 1940, the Saturday Evening Post had a writer who dealt in frauds and scams. And he'd just written a tremendous series of articles on the corruption in the labor movement in the docks of Philadelphia. His next assignment was to find out about AA and write an expose of AA. And he went to AA and was astonished to discover it was not at all secret, not at all frightening, not at all threatening. It was absolutely what it said it would be. He traveled all over the country where there's alcoholics. He went to St. Louis, went to Chicago, went to Los Angeles, talked to people, and it was just what he said, what they said it was. And he wrote this great article, and it made AA just all of a sudden well-known, because there was no place that was helping alcoholics of our type at that time, or any other time for that matter. So it really got a lot of letters, and they started groups all over in all the cities. Thousands of people got into AA. But after a year or two, they started dying off again, and people were arguing and fighting, and groups were quitting, and people getting drunk, and Bill Wilson would sit in his office, read these letters, another group has died, another city is without AA, and just baffled by it. And in 1945, in an effort to try to unify things, he started this thing called the Grapevine, which was a big, like a tabloid. And that didn't do much, but some guy in North Carolina sent an article and said, "Bill, I don't know if you know about this, read about this, you'll find it interesting." And he'd written an article for the Grapevine about the Washingtonians. And Bill Wilson had never heard of the Washingtonians. And it turned out there had been a group just exactly 100 years before, 1840. Six drunks got together in a bar, back of a bar. One of them just was out of jail. And he came back to his friend and said, "You know, those people, the minister up there said he knew how I feel. He doesn't know how I feel. Those guys don't know. You guys are the only guys who know how I feel, you five guys. And yeah, I know, we all understand each other. But we got to stop drinking." He said, "Well, maybe we could help each other stop drinking somehow. I don't know how we can do that." And he said, "Yeah, you six drunks, you're going to help people stop drinking. That's ha, ha, ha." But they drew up a little charter. They elected officers, the six of them. I guess there were one guy who wasn't an officer. He felt bad. And they decided to name themselves after they'd been going for a little while, after George Washington, because nobody ever heard of drunks helping drunks. Washington was the first of a kind. And some people came from Baltimore. This was in Baltimore. Some people came from Philadelphia and heard about it, went back and started a little group in Philadelphia. Somebody else started a little group in Washington. And it kind of staggered forward. And pretty soon they got somebody from Boston heard about it and came down and went back in Boston, got some people started. And little by little, these idiots were staying sober. And nobody could believe it. And at the end of the first year, they decided, well, we should celebrate. We started in March, but George Washington's birthday was February 22nd. We'll make that our anniversary date. And they were in several states by this time, a number of people staying sober. And then they, in the second year, they got a couple of guys in who were really great speakers. And in those days, there was no telephones or radios or anything like that. So most communications were in mass meetings with speakers. And these guys were out just grave talks saying, you don't have to drink anymore. And near the end of the second year, people still thought they were kind of goofy, but they thought, they tried to find all the chapters they had, and they sent them a letter saying, this, on our second anniversary, get somebody from your local community, some opinion maker, and have him come in and give a talk. Not that we care what he says so much, but he will see we're not crazy. And then maybe you spread the word. So all over the country, and a lot of states by this time, in Springfield, Illinois, the young man they had come in was a guy named Abraham Lincoln. If you read the book of Lincoln's speeches, there's a book, one from April or February 22nd, 1842, in which he talks at length, but the gist of his remarks is, I don't understand what this is to you folks. I know you to be fine people, but I don't have the thirst you have, so I can't identify, but I want to wish you well, and so on. And it continued to grow. By 1845, it was estimated their membership was 100,000 sober drunkards. And there had never been anything like it in the history of the world. Now, you may think that doesn't sound like a lot of people. AA, with all of its activities and all of its inventions, didn't have 1,000 people after five years. And then after they had 5 years, they got thinking, you know, we really have helped a lot of drunkards, but there's a lot of other people with problems too. We should try to help them, perhaps. We should help narcotics addicts who are not drunkards, not heroin and cocaine like today, but they had opium and other drugs that people were on. And maybe we should get involved in political work and help. Maybe we should help have the government run right. And a great many of them got into the stamping out of the sale of alcohol, because if there was no sales of alcohol, there'd be no alcoholism, and on and on. And these 100,000 people just dedicated themselves to making the world a better place. And by 1848, the movement was extinct, with all very few exceptions. All of them died drunken deaths. I have a book home written by one of the few survivors in 1861. He says, I don't know what happened. We were doing so well, and then people got so involved in doing so many things, they didn't have time to come to our meetings or help other drunkards anymore, and pretty soon they all left. And Bill Wilson wrote that and read that and thought, my God. And he looked up the Washingtonians in the library and found out about it and was staggered, because that is exactly, among other things, that was happening to Alcoholics Anonymous. They had other problems too. They were so diffused in what they were doing, and they were fighting over authority and power, and they were fighting who's getting the most things in the newspapers. I mean, the Washingtonians had every flaw that we tried to fight against. And as a result of that article and the series of thoughts it brought about, he sat down, and in a last gasp effort to save AA, he wrote the 12 Traditions. 1945, 10 years after AA started. Not in the form we read them or you read them now, but in the long form. If you're not familiar with those, in the back of the book, across the short form is the long form, and it fleshes them out a little bit. And he issued them one by one in this new thing called the grapevine. And most people didn't want to hear about it. We don't need rules. This is a spiritual movement. We have rules. And most people didn't accept him. He started a very famous tour around the country from time to time. He'd put his wife in his sidecar and his motorcycle. They'd drive to meetings and explain, this is not meanness, this is not rules, this is we're trying to save AA. In fact, it got to a point, if you can imagine this, groups would say, Bill, please come and speak at our anniversary, our second anniversary, our first anniversary. Unless you're going to talk about the traditions, then don't come, we don't want you. I mean, that's how bad it was. And by 1949, some people had accepted the traditions, but AA nationwide and in Ireland or every place else there was AA were not willing to accept these rules, they felt. So Bill and Dr. Bob got together. Their followers were fought a lot, but they got together and decided if we could just have one meeting someplace, we could explain this to these people and they'd understand it. So they set up the first they thought, the only international convention of Alcoholics Anonymous, the same one that will be celebrated next year in Toronto. Only this was in Cleveland on July 4th weekend, 1950. I have the tapes home from that convention. They're very poor quality, but they're very interesting. A lot of things went on. Dr. Bob was dying of cancer, and they said he probably didn't want to talk, but he insisted on it. He said, I'm 15 years sober. I'm the second oldest sober person in the world. And his son, another guy, helped this tall, gaunt man to the podium, and he gave what has come down in the annals of AA to be like the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. Most of you have heard it, read it. He welcomed you. I want to welcome you all to Cleveland. I hope you enjoy here. I hope you'll go back and tell the boys and girls in your home group that we're all here together. And he says, I look over this vast group of people. I'm glad that some small thing I did a few years ago helped bring this about. And he said, I want to apologize for my health. I've been in bed most of the last few months. And just some introductory remarks. But then he got to the meat of what he had to say. But he said, I want to just talk about two or three things that I think are of great interest. And in the next couple of minutes, he talked about things that are as pertinent tonight in Bristol as they were that day in Cleveland. He said, first, let us remember, he said, let us remember to keep our program pure. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but it's nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. He didn't say, let's keep our program poor. He said, let's keep our program simple. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like it who does know exactly what he's talking about. When we're feeling good, we're all expansive and pleasant. Ha ha ha. But does somebody threaten us or hurt our feelings, then slash and cut and burn. And finally, he said, none of us would be here if someone hadn't taken the time to maybe take us to a few meetings, give us a pat on the back when we need it, explain things to us. He said, let us never reach that stage of smug complacency. We are too busy to help our fellow brethren who are yet to come. And he sat down and was dead shortly thereafter. But incidentally, just a funny little anecdote you may find interesting. You mentioned Bill Wilson dying in 1971, January. I heard him give his last talk in Miami Beach in 1970, or I thought I was going to hear it. At every international convention, that convention went so well, incidentally, that they decided to have him every 5 years. I went to my first one in 1960 in Long Beach, and 65 in Toronto, and 70 in Miami Beach. And Bill Wilson talked at the Friday night meeting, and people were just always came so excited, you know. And here we are in Miami Beach, 10,000 people in this convention center waiting for Bill to come out, and nobody knew how sick he was. The guy finally came out and said, I have some bad news. Bill is too sick to talk. His illness is too far gone. And God had just... it's just a balloon punctured. And he said, but we do have a substitute speaker. Okay. I felt sorry for him. Well, but he came out and talked. And on the way back to the hotel, I was walking with an old timer who'd gotten sober under Dr. Bob. I said, isn't that too bad, John, that McHugh, his name was, he's an American-Irishman. I said, isn't that too bad? We'll never hear Bill talk. He said, he'll talk at this convention. I said, no, he won't. I got friends in the World Service House. They say he's not going to talk. He'll talk. I just got a feeling. Well, maybe he knows something. So the next night, there was another big meeting. I thought maybe he'll talk here, but he didn't. The last big meeting, Sunday morning, this must be the time, but they introduced the regular speaker, and he got up to give a talk. But halfway through his talk, somebody came over and tugged him. And he turned and said, I have some wonderful news. An ambulance has just brought Bill Wilson to the back door, and he wants to say a few words. And they wheeled him in a wheelchair, and he had tubes up. He was dying from emphysema. And God, everybody jumped up and clapped and cheered, and the organist played Climb Every Mountain, and it just sent shivers down. And some of you have heard that tape. He said, "I'm so glad to be here, friends, and I know that God will help us continue on our work as long as we do His work." And then it kind of sounded like the tape broke. He ran out of air, slumped back in his wheelchair, and they wheeled him out. God, this is a great moment. But on the way back to the hotel, I was walking with John again. I said, "John, how the hell did you know that Bill Wilson was going to talk?" "Nobody knew that." He said, "Kid, remember, you're dealing with human beings. They may be inspired human beings, but they're human beings. Do you think Bill Wilson would want to have said that Dr. Bob talked while he was dying and Bill wouldn't?" But really kind of a touching anecdote. But at that same convention, they had six young guys with a, kind of, you could, I don't know who they were. They each took two traditions and explained them, but they weren't really rules, they were just suggestions. And I mean, they're so excited, you can just hear their tails wag. I mean, and I want to talk to you about this. And even at the end of all that, I mean, you know, they're persuading people. These are not laws or rules. We don't even have any way to enforce them. We have no way to enforce them. If you break the traditions, we can't punish you. We can't keep you out of meetings. You know, we don't have any AA police. As you get sober longer, you kind of wish you did. You know. Like, for instance, in my area, I have been known unfairly as kind of a dictator-type sponsor. And what people never seem to realize is that you can be a dictator-type sponsor only with 100% cooperation of the dictatee. If he doesn't like it, he says, "Screw you," and the dictatorship is over. And I've always thought it'd be nice if we had police who could come at night and say, "Did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us to the camp for a little training." But they gave this wonderful tradition start. And even then, Bill Wilson wasn't quite certain. And you hear that tape, he said, "We've now heard the traditions explained. As everyone understands it, I see no objections. We accept them." And they've been a way of life. But one of the great things in there was to profit from the Washingtonian movement and to remember the singleness of purpose. Without that, it is just another therapy. It's just another group therapy. The thing that makes the Washingtonians and Alcoholics Anonymous the only two therapies that have ever, ever worked on a continuing basis for alcoholics of our type. The only thing that they have in common almost, I mean, they have the goals in common, but they are the only two organizations that are comprised of alcoholics talking to alcoholics. Because the great enemy of every alcoholic is his secret knowledge that he is different. And unless you can get through that, he will never get better. That's why to this day, after all the therapies and all the great AA everywhere in the world, and there's just wonderful in America where there's more sobriety than any place in the history of mankind. It is still estimated that something over 90% of alcoholics of our type still die drunk. Not because AA doesn't work, but because you don't understand. My case is different. That's the kind of thing that won't help me. It's really frightening. But anyway, that is why to this day, it is so consistently correct, I believe. Unless you're an alcoholic, it's very hard to identify. Now, I've been working with addicts, non-alcoholic addicts, for over 30 years. But I'll tell you, if I sit in an AA meeting and some guy can get up and give a long, wonderful talk on narcotics, it's just a lecture to me. I don't identify with it. I know what they're talking about. But give me some goof who gets up and says, "I drank an awful lot and I don't know what the hell made me do it, but I'm staying sober and I got a sponsor and he's mean to me and I'm feeling better and thank you very much." You bet, baby, I know how that feels, you bet. Probably the best illustration I know on that field of identification. When I was about 2 years sober, I gave a little talk in an AA club, just a small meeting. I talked on obsessions. Not on how to overcome them. I didn't know how to overcome them. I just knew all about obsessions because I had them all. And some woman came up and she said, "Oh, that's just wonderful." She said, "Some friends and I have started a little group called Overeaters Anonymous. and we don't have any speakers. Would you go over and talk and tell our ladies about the obsessions? I said, sure. I was weighed about 130 pounds. I was skinny, had no front teeth, just... The next Sunday, I went over to the Overeaters Anonymous meeting. About eight fat old ladies sitting around a table. And I gave them a talk on obsessions, and I thought it probably helped them a lot. They were going, And I sat down and thought, well, I've certainly carried a message to these poor souls. Then they had participation, and these people talked, I couldn't believe my ears. Woman over here had made a two-layer cake for her son's birthday. And he was at military school in Long Beach, and her husband went down there to get him, and she took one taste of that cake and another taste. By the time they got back, it was gone, the whole cake. I didn't say anything, I'm too nice a guy, but I was, geez, can't you just have a piece of cake? Over over here talking about eating ice cream, going to get some more ice cream, and having more ice cream. And I didn't say anything, but I thought to myself, geez, no wonder you're fat, for Christ's sake. Woman over here talked about eating till she couldn't eat anymore. And then she put her finger down her throat to throw up so she could eat some more. I thought to myself, don't bother shaking hands with me after this. Now, what was the difference? Food did to them something it didn't do to me. It was not, I could intellectually understand it, but there was no identification. Well, that identification is just information. It would never get me to do anything. And that's why it is so imperative that we remember in our groups to talk about alcohol and alcoholism so that newcomers can identify and not hear some lecture on abstruse substances that may be lethal and deadly but have nothing to do with our problem here. The man who founded Gamblers Anonymous, Jim Willis, a friend of mine, he founded, which became the most successful of all the non-AA movements. It was the first and the most successful. It still is active all over the world. I mean, and he got very active in it, and by the mid-1960s, he had got so active in GA, he had just about cut AA off. And so they were very surprised when he got drunk and died. And people couldn't understand that. But in GA, they still revere him. He never did gamble again. He did not do that. And his picture's still up there, like Bill Wilson's up for us. Jim Willis, the founder of GA. And he wasn't a bad man. He didn't do anything wrong. He just stopped doing the things that kept alcoholics sober. So I think it's almost safe to say that until something really different comes along, it is quite consistent with our recovery to require the use of discussions on alcoholism and that members of Alcoholics Anonymous be alcoholics. In fact, some of you have seen, of course, there's a little pamphlet called Problems Other Than Alcohol. When they asked Bill, must a member be an alcoholic to be a member? He said, yes. Can we suggest that they can be a member even if they're not alcoholics? No. I'm just quite clear. And it's not because we're being insular or trying to put people down or we're not above or below them. It's just the nature of our recovery is based on identification. Without identification, no meaningful actions get taken. Without the actions, there's no recovery. Now, there may be an argument for the next one. They wanted to get rid of the Lord's Prayer, Serenity Prayer, because the Lord's Prayer is too religious, too Christian. And when you really think about this, kind of funny. I don't know if you've ever read where the Serenity Prayer is from. It's from a longer poem by a man named Reinhold Niebuhr, which is the most religious Christian poem in the history of the world. Christ wants to do that, and they took those two little lines out, but that is really a religious tract. The Lord's Prayer, I can't imagine why they think it's so religious, because it really is nothing. It was said by Christ, I guess, but that doesn't make it a Christian prayer. He wasn't a Christian when he said it. He was a Jewish guy. And what does he say that's so terrible, that's antithetical to what we believe in this room? He asked for our Father in heaven, wherever you want him to be, and give us this day our daily bread, and Let us forgive our trespasses like we forgive those who trespass around us. We make our amends. And all the way through, it's just, it's almost like the 12 steps. And people are willing to give up their sorority to keep from saying that dreadful prayer because it's too religious. And there's not, you don't have to believe in it. You just have to say it. That's another one of the things here. When people are new and this offends them, I have to tell them, you don't have to believe it. You just have to say it. Like the actions here. I don't know why it works, but altogether it seems to work somehow. And I don't particularly care. They say, well, it offends the Jewish members. I don't think so. My home group, the Pacific group, meets in the synagogue of all places. The rabbi comes to our meetings once in a while. He says the Lord's Prayer. The 9 people I sponsor who are Jewish have no argument with it, but some newcomer little snot all of a sudden is offended by it. And I say to them, have you seen my muscle? Those of you who are listening to this on tape will never know what I just did. I don't mean to be difficult about it, but it really is, you know, to think about that, to fight and argue in AA about saying the Lord's Prayer is so silly because there's nothing in there that even connotes religion. You accept a higher power. You want to take certain action that makes you feel better. Give us this day our daily bread. Deliver us from temptation. Is there anything here there that you don't hear in an AA meeting? For thine is the power and the glory forever and ever. In fact, they don't say that in the Catholic Church, but when Catholics are in AA and priests are in AA, they say it. And yet some little newcomer snot can't say it because it bothers them. Well, I don't judge. I'm just reporting. But I don't see any argument there. The last argument is really one of the bigger ones today in the world. Medications have taken such strides. And alcoholics, it's the funny thing about alcoholics, they seem to have great epidemics of things. About 4 or 5 years ago, seemingly half of AA suddenly caught being bipolar. Nobody ever heard of it before, but they suddenly realized they had it when the medications were available. Years before that, before most of you were here, was hypoglycemia. Yes, I'm hypoglycemic. And the doctor insists I take these pills. I don't think you should. You're not a doctor. Don't tell me what to do. And yet there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I absolutely know that without the correct medication are just crazier than June bugs. We have 2 or 3 in our group. I sponsor a woman, very distinguished woman, but she is clinically insane, or psychotic. If she does not take that continuing antipsychotic drug, she'll go down. So where do you make the difference? Why all the medication all of a sudden? And I think one of the reasons is this, probably the main reason, that alcoholism itself is a strange disease. It is characterized, especially in the early sobriety, by vast swings of emotions, ups and downs and ups and downs. It almost is indistinguishable from manic depression. It is almost indistinguishable from bipolarism, which is... And so it is natural to go to a doctor, explain these symptoms, and even if they're in doubt, they usually will give you a prescription. Dr. Paul Olinger, some of you remember him, his story was in the book, Doctor Addict, someone else, and it's under a new name now, the new book. But I knew him well. I've watched him get sober. He used to come to our group a lot, and I've known him very well. But he explained to me, he said, you know, Clancy, after you've been sober a while, you can't blame the doctors, really. Here they sit with an ante room full of sick people who desperately need help. And in their office is somebody whining, I feel bad. They look at me funny on the bus. What am I going to do? Why don't you just take these? And it's like you take care of sick people. Because neurosis takes many forms. And I would say, think it's safe to say that almost any sober alcoholic in their early sobriety, unless they are very rare indeed, went through tremendous swings. And some, when you just know if you're going to make it, another day you can be totally elated. It's just wonderful to be sober. And I can hardly wait till tomorrow when I'll be suicidal. And 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 it is this very condition that Alcoholics Anonymous and its actions work to treat. And antidepressants are very nice things, and they help a little bit, I guess. But, you know, as we learn more and more about them, they are becoming more and more questionable, even the antidepressants, to say nothing of the really strong ones. But new studies this year have indicated that people who stay on antidepressants become suicidal. In fact, there was a study about a month ago made the front page of the paper where children on antidepressants were committing suicide at a rather fast rate. Antidepressants at best were designed for a short-term period, but once people get on them, they can't get off. And you can't really say to people, get off those things, because they can't get off. It's ridiculous to realize how addictive these things are. And the solution I have found with the people I know, when people come to me and say, but I do take these strong antidepressants, and I know I can't, it would be lethal to say, just get off it. So I do, I talk to their doctor, I go to the doctor, or have them do it, and suggest to the doctor, can we possibly start weaning this person off, little by little, withdrawing them, little by little. Because I know it's a medical thing that has to be done. I'm not a doctor. But we've weaned a number of people off if they're willing to do it. But some of them then say, no, I'm not going to go to the doctor and wean off. I need them. My case is different. Then I have to tell them, well, you know, I can't be your sponsor. Not just because I disapprove of it, but I have no experience of that. So therefore, I can't really guide you. And that's a good answer to tell people if they are doing something that you have not done and can't fathom. I cannot really help you because I have not taken medications like that, and I don't know how it must be. But it seems as though the patterns of alcoholics are still the same. And more, one of the sad things in modern treatment of alcoholics, I don't know how it is in Europe, but in America, the major treatment centers, they stuff them full of antidepressants and put them out in the street. And they say, boy, look how well they're doing. And they look great. But they're addicted to another form of semi-intoxication. My philosophy on that has always been what I learned, is that AA is not designed to get you off alcohol. AA is designed to get you to live in reality. Whatever form of unreality you'd get away from, that's a bad thing. So, and it's a matter of taste, I suppose. There are still people make arguments that we shouldn't discuss these things in AA. We shouldn't talk about asking people to get off the drugs. But to me, I can't conceive it. I came out of the Texas State Insane Asylum in 1957, and I had to take massive doses of Thorazine, which was a very, very strong drug. Because I'd been in there as a successful suicide, sober, and I was goofy. And I took those Thorazine, and I took them right until the time I ran out of them, and I got drunk. And I remember, I didn't know how strong they were. One of my daughters, my wife would put a big orange tablet on my plate twice a day. And one of my little daughters, 4 years old, came over, and I'd see what Daddy was having, and took one and slept for 3 days. The doctor's going to be all right, but God, it's just terribly powerful. Anything in our group, and I'm not saying this is right, and I'm not saying you should do it. I'm saying that our group, the largest and most successful A group in the world, our qualification for a birthday cake or a medallion is simply this, that you are sober of anything that affects you from the neck up. It affects your perception of reality. Now, these two or three people who are antipsychotic drugs, we know it does it for them, but that is really clinically absolutely essential. But for most of us, all of us, deep within us, we know our case is different. And if anybody deserves antidepressants, it's me, because my emotions are so raw. And we have to educate people out of that, it seems like. So when you really look about it, here we are, 60 years old, 60 years old, and we're at a turning spot, and there are four things we really have to examine. should we really examine them a great deal? What should we talk about them? What should we do about them? But we have to examine, for example, if we should not be so selective about having to be alcoholics. Of course we should. And we must do that if we're going to provide newcomers with a solution. And the other aspects I talked about tonight, medications, the Lord's Prayer, so on. These things seem out of date to some people, but they're not out of date because they are part of a therapeutic. Change the book. They are part of, in overall, a therapeutic that is the first time in living in history of mankind where large groups of alcoholics of our type have stayed sober. Every variation on them has failed. Every variation has failed. I don't know if you remember this, you probably didn't see it, but in 1990, one of the major networks in America did a hour special on Alcoholics Anonymous. Did you see that? I'll have to send it over here, you'll see, because it really is quite good. They have four members throughout the country that they talk to, very anonymous. I was one of them. Now do you recognize me? But they, to show the other side of the coin, they also had a woman on there who had been in AA and had established a new thing called recovery. And she had her book. She said, yes, I know these Alcoholics Anonymous members feel well, and maybe they need this. But I've written recovery on how people like us can drink safely again if we remember certain rules. And I thought, what? I saw it on television. But I found out later, she had taped her segment in January. This ran in June. By the time it ran, she was in the Washington State Penitentiary for vehicular homicides because she's drunkenly gone through an intersection and killed three people. And her last remark was, I'm going back to AA. I wanted to send her a letter and said, oh, geez, I'm so glad, you bag. But every conceivable variation, they had groups called atheists, alcoholic atheists. They've had all sorts of recoveries and all sorts of things, and nothing has ever worked. The only thing that has ever worked is Alcoholics Anonymous. Simple, direct. And all you and I have to remember about it is this. Let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but have nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is. We all know what service is. And let us guard that erring member of the tongue and try to use it with kindness and understanding. And none of us would be here if someone hadn't taken the time to maybe take us to a few meetings or explain things to us, give us a pat on the back when we needed it. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency where we no longer have time to help our less fortunate brother. And if we remember that, we won't have to change anything. Thank you.